Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Shobana Xavier, and I hope you're well and staying safe wherever you are. And thank you so much for joining us today. Today, we are joined by Amir Artaban Sadagat, who is a lecturer at the University of Toronto, to discuss his new book, Translating Rumi into the West, A Linguistic Conundrum and Beyond, published by Routledge this year in 2023. Rumi, the 13th century Muslim Persian mystic, is a best-selling poet, of course, especially in the English language world. But how do his works of translation and adaptations into English language stand in terms of literal and cultural translations into the West? Sadagat explores these important questions from translation studies perspective, especially with the focus on questions of semiotics. The book addresses linguistic and pragmatic questions of translation, such as how text, gender, language, and lexicon can or cannot be translated, to important challenges, particularly with Rumi's poetry, which are deeply tied to kinetic and musical dimensions that also perhaps cannot be translated. What then are the ethical challenges to these paradoxes of untranslatability and the reception politics of Rumi into the global West? These are some of the questions the book explores. This book will be of interest to any Rumi enthusiast, which I think is a lot of people out there, scholars of translation, mysticism, Sufism, Persian and Iranian studies, and much more. In our conversation today, we spoke about Rumi and mysticism, the challenges of translating, for instance, gender or cultural aspects and mystical work of Rumi in text, and the ethics of translation and the responsibilities of translators to be transparent with their projects to the reader. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Amir Artaban Sadagat about his new book, Translating Rumi into the West, Linguistic Conundrum and Beyond. Hi, Amir. Thank you so much for joining us in the New Books in Islamic Studies podcast to talk about your book, Translating Rumi into the West, A Linguistic Conundrum and Beyond. How are you doing today?
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm fine. Thank you.
Yeah. We have a tradition in the podcast that when we do meet with our authors of books, we like to ask a little bit about their intellectual journey. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what your academic or intellectual background and journey is, and what led you to writing this particular book on Rumi and translation.
Well, I'll begin with the last part of your question. This is This is part of my PhD thesis research, which I turned into this book, the thesis that I defended 7 years ago. So my background was engineering back home in Iran. But then I changed to French literature, went to Paris, got my PhD in translation studies, doing a lot of semiotics and linguistics. But my PhD thesis was on the reception of Rumi in the Western, but more specifically English speaking and French speaking societies. So France, the UK, and all over North America. So that was my PhD defended in 2015, on which I worked for 7 years. And I was not particularly familiar with Rumi before that, because I was more in the, I had worked more in the field of linguistics and semiotics. But yeah, that was the advice of my supervisor to look into something which makes use of my knowledge of Persian and Persian literature. Voila. So I worked on Rumi. Starting in 2009. This book is the result of my work in, my collaboration with the Toronto Initiative for Iranian Studies. So I had a couple of lectures there at the University of Toronto, presided over by Dr. Tavakoli, at the University of Toronto, Middle Eastern Studies. So he suggested that I turn this originally French thesis defended in Paris to English. So he said, well, rewrite it or translate it into English. While in the process of rewriting it, I changed probably more than 60% of it. I definitely tried to expand my scope to the the reception of Rumi in the entire West. So I looked into other languages. Those I had some rudimentary knowledge in, like Italian, Spanish, and some German, and those which I didn't know anything of, like Russian, using tools, electronic digital tools, to find out about how Rumi has been received, how he's been translated in other non-English and French-speaking countries. Voilà. So that's the journey.
That's it. No, it's amazing. It's also amazing to think about that the book is itself a translation or a shift from another language. Like when you were working in French, your command of languages and the kind of the repertoire and landscape that you're working with or the corpus you're working with is amazing. I don't come from a linguistic background, so I'm just kind of profoundly stunned by some of the labor and the archives and kind of the graphs and everything. It was just like really interesting to sit with this book for a little bit and like think about it. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your methodological process. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get into that a little bit more, but like what was your, did you have to journey or travel to get to particular archives, like, or as a translation scholar, how would you describe your methodological process for perhaps people, some of our listeners who may not know the field as much?
So I used the archives I had, the corpus that I had prepared during my PhD thesis. I just needed to broaden that corpus by adding other translations, other titles in other languages to it. But generally, well, to begin with, in back in 2010, when I started working on this research, looked at the two major works of Rumi, chose the best editions available, the oldest and the best. So both, because they're not always synonymous, as you know. And then I tried to choose some of the choose my excerpts based on the availability of the maximum availability of translations in French and English. So my examples are from poems or texts that have been, of which we have the highest number of translations in English and in French. So I tried to have like show how different translators belonging to different eras and different cultural spheres translated the same excerpt, same text, or the same poem, if we want to call it, because it's not always a poem. It's a part of a poem. It's just a few verses of a poem, or sometimes it is the entire poem. In the case of quatrains or odes of the Divan of Shams, the Divan of the Shams of Tabriz. So that was the way I put together my corpus, which is a large one. It is available in French on online. I think I have given the address on in the book somewhere in the bibliography. So the original thesis is available online. It's a big one. It's 500 pages, and then it is in two volumes. And the second volume is just my corpus, and that's about 250, 300 pages. Because when you add up all the texts from Masnavi and from Divan, and you add all the translations in French and English, that becomes quite big. That's a large chunk of texts. So that was how I put together my corpus. Then I looked at the problem of translation, reception in a broader standpoint, from different approaches, like from different points of view. So translation, well, that's pretty much the methodology we use in translation studies. So translation studies has, well, to put it in a nutshell, to sum it up, translation studies has three major levels of analyzing, of analysis. The textual analysis, the analysis of, well, the textual analysis at the level of énoncé or utterances. So how translating a particular sentence, let's say, is associated with difficulties from a certain language to another. Then you look at it from a larger, in a larger scale, you look at the entire text, how the translation of a text can be analyzed. And then you go a level higher and you look at the politics of translation. So how circumstances that are beyond the text or the translator can affect the quality of translation, the quality and the modality of like how you translate. It's not necessarily a critical analysis of the quality. It's just, it could be perfectly descriptive, showing how certain circumstances can change how people translate and why people translate.
Yeah.
So yeah, the different levels are the text, the translator, and what is beyond. So that could be editors, that could be the zeitgeist of the era in which the translator translates. Voila. So these are the three levels. At the first level, I had the linguistic analysis showing how translating from Persian to English or French or other, by the same token, the Romance languages, they're quite comparable to French, and Germanic languages, they're quite comparable to English to some extent. I mean, I think there's more difference between German and English than between French and Spanish, in a way, especially when it comes to translation, because they have different traditions of translation. Well, anyways, but so the linguistic difficulties talked about how translating Persian to begin with can be challenging. What are the challenges and how translators have overcome those challenges? Then I looked at the higher level, which is the style and rhetoric and poetics of Rumi, and how poetics of Rumi, because of its association with music, can pose a serious challenge to translation, to the translation of his poetry, given that it is almost impossible to recreate the original musicality of poetry. This is generally true, but this is all truer in the case of Rumi, because to my knowledge, his poetry is one of the most important examples of musicality in Persian literature. And Persian literature has a structure, Persian and Arabic literatures, Persian and Arabic poetries have this ability because of their prosodic system. They have a meter, the metric system of versification is chronemic. So it is based on timing, not only the number of syllables. So because of this, I mean, thanks to this, they create some of the most rhythmic and musical examples of poetry in among all languages. And then, well, I went to other questions. I asked questions of ethical nature, how ethics can, I mean, what role ethics has to play in translation, and how from ethical theories of translation we can evaluate the perception of Rumi in the West. And I had two approaches to answer those questions. The approaches coming from, it's the approaches that looked into the factors associated with the worldview of translators themselves, and then the politics of translation. And that was probably the part that would be most appealing to your listeners and viewers. And that's the end of the book, yeah.
So yeah, I think you've given... Yeah. As a great overview, I think the book really has kind of the first two chapters deals with interesting or important questions in terms of translation studies. And then it shifts in the second half, or in the middle of the book, shifts into really focusing on Rumi. I think one of the amazing things about your book is all these examples of how different translations have unfolded. I really loved engaging that and like seeing them side by side in the charts that you outlaid. That's not a word, but outlined, that's the word. And that was really fantastic. And then towards, as you say, the last two chapters deal with these broader ethical questions, which I think everybody who is thinking about Rumi, or as you say, a lot of our listeners are probably grappling with how do we deal with the kind of the ethical challenges of how Rumi is being translated by some folks. And I think you give us some really important language to navigate that landscape, because, you know, any translation is going to be some form of a political reality that we have to engage with. Since you kind of outlined some of the aspects, I wonder if you could even do a broader stroke. Translation studies is one of the major components or theoretical frameworks of the book. The other ones you highlight in your introduction chapter are these issues of mysticism, Sufism, Irfan, and even the problematics of defining what constitutes mysticism in relationship to Islam and non in relationship to non-Islam, which is another issue, particularly to translating Rumi. And then also now the figure of Rumi. We're kind of operating under the assumption that everybody knows who Rumi is, and I think most of our listeners do. But you do a really good job in the introduction to set up, well, why is this particular example of Rumi a productive or generative case study in relation to these broader questions of translation you're asking? And one of that has to do with this piece of, well, what is the hermeneutic, what is the worldview of Rumi that makes it even more challenging to do the translation, right? So can you talk a little bit about these bigger questions that you're also asking in relationship to translation studies and translation theories?
Yeah, I think even the most basic questions of linguistic nature could be quite juicy from a political standpoint. I mean, even the driest linguistic analyses of something like gender or the absence thereof in Persian and some other languages, and how it can pose a serious problem that can be analyzed from a political standpoint is quite quintessential of the kind of the problem we're dealing with when it comes to translation of Gnostic mystical poetry, especially from Persian. Well, the question of gender, well, we know that, I don't know if all the listeners are familiar with Persian, but in Persian we have no differentiation between a third person feminine and masculine. So and on the other hand, we know that mystical poetry is all about the unspoken, the metaphorical, the metasemical, the change of meaning, figurative meanings, and yeah, well, it's mystical. So the very fact that while translating into English or French or any other gendered language, for that matter, the translator is faced with the difficult choice of giving a gender to the third person, ungendered, agendered pronouns, or any reference, linguistic reference in the text, in the original text, in the source text. So when Rumi talks about the beloved, Well, it's easier in English because English is not completely gendered compared to Romance languages or German or Russian for that matter. But still, you have to give a he or she somewhere. So, I mean, when it comes to pronouns, you need to specify the gender. In French or in Romance languages, that's even more difficult because you have references everywhere to the gender. So how would you translate the beloved of a mystical poetry in Arabic or in Persian? Well, especially Persian, because in Persian there is no gender. You never know if the beloved of Rumi is Shams, who's a guy, or is a girl, or is God. And if it is God, how would we translate, how would we gender God? Is it masculine? Is it feminine? Why? And that actually raises a lot of questions of political and ethical. So the other issue, well, a big chunk of the book is probably too technical for the majority of readers. It's a semiotic analysis. I give a lot of background in semiotics in order to justify my analysis later on, both in the hermeneutic and rhetoric and poetic analyses of translation of the poetry and then its translation, Rumi's poetry, I mean. So that theoretical background aside, which is a good half of the second chapter, when we go to the hermeneutics of Rumi, I was interested in observing how different translators have been also commentators of Rumi, and how they have found it difficult or even failed to play a role as translators rather than commentators and try to interpret the hermetic, mystical message of the poetry. By message, I mean just simply semantic content of the poetry for their non-Iranian, non-Persian speaking, English speaking, or French speaking, or well, other languages, readers. So that was one of the problems I found with most translators. But for some, I tried to distinguish commentaries by translators' notes, commentaries by translators that I think would damage the integrity of the original text in the way that when something is mute in the like or silent or unspoken of or mystical, deliberately mystified by the poet, why should the translator try to interpret it from a specific standpoint, affected, influenced by specific ideologies? So that was what I have tried to show in my analysis, and I have tried to evaluate different eras and different tendencies, different waves of translation in terms of their prise de position, their positioning in terms of the hermeneutics of the mystical poetry of Rumi, that is how to interpret what is essentially open to interpretation. I mean, what is supposed to remain open to interpretation, even in the target text, even in English. And the question of gender was part of it. I mean, what I noticed in many translations, in the majority of translations, was that translators tend to first assume that the beloved we're talking about, a gendered beloved, is God, which is questionable, open to debate. Secondly, make it masculine without explaining the reality, which is not very hard to explain. You just need to put a note and explain that I don't know the gender because the Persian text doesn't have gender. Voila. So that was a part of it. There were other issues, like the question of coherence, especially in Masnavi, as a narrative text. I mean, essentially narrative text. It's a mystical didactic work of Rumi, but the great majority of it is basically a series of tales of mystical nature and message. And the question of coherence in Masnavi is an interesting one, and that there have been works I have cited in my book that look into the apparent incoherence of the narrative techniques Rumi uses in Masnavi. He starts a tale, he talks about something, and then in the middle of it, there's another one. There's a mise en abîme, as we say in narratology. He talks about something else. Then within the parentheses, he opens another set of parentheses and so on and so forth, in a way that at the end of the tale, you're completely lost. You don't get what's going on. Which is quite similar to the way Quran or even the Old Testament tell you stories. I'm not sure if Rumi was consciously imitating sacred texts in his Masnavi, but yeah, that's a pretty comparable to cases. And interestingly, the question of coherence is important manifests itself in an interesting way in translation, especially in prose translation, when translators try to put some order in the disorder, in the apparent disorder of the source text. Voila. So from those hermeneutic analyses, we can go towards questions of ethical nature. So to what extent translators should allow themselves to regulate the original text, to interpret it, to give an exegesis instead of a translation of the original text. And voila, I tried to evaluate different eras and different waves of translations and different translators in terms of their ethical tendencies, without trying to be too critical, especially, well, let me just point this out. When I started working on this research, on this question of translating Rumi, I was very critical of what we call popularizing translations of Rumi, those that are even difficult, whose source texts are even difficult to pinpoint. So they're so open that we can't actually call them translations. They're not translations. They're adaptations at best, and texts written under the inspiration of Rumi at worst. I was very critical of those translators, especially from North America, especially from the end of the 20th and the and up to date, up to date. I was very critical of them, but then with me maturing over, I don't know, 15 years of working in this field, I became more overt, more open, more accepting of them, at least recognizing their, I've come to accept them as useful in their own function, which is popularizing Rumi. That is probably if the only translation of Rumi was the text and the were published in the late 19th or 20, early 20th century, Rumi wouldn't have been known to this extent in the world. So we do owe them a debt to those popularizing translators who the majority of whom don't even speak Persian, don't even read Persian. And their works are retranslations. So voilà. I don't know. Well, there's one topic left, and I'm gonna leave you leave you ask me the question probably about the politics of reception.
But yeah, no, I think it's so helpful to hear you speak in broad strokes because you've hit a lot of really important points. I will note to the listeners that you have, I think one of the really fantastic contributions of this book is you've just mapped out for us, like charted the different translations, and you've like compared, and you're very generous, I think, as a scholar, even though you have all of these technical attributes that you're signaling, like you say in chapter one and chapter two, you kind of highlight how certain things of, the literal translation, as you say, gender was one of the components, form, lexicon, all these other dimensions. But you are also modeling for us how this plays out with, let's say, translators like Arbery, I know, who are coming from an Orientalist context, or Nicholson. You're moving to kind of contemporary translators as well. Barks, kind of as you're signaling to towards the end, as kind of these not really translators, but individuals who are adapting or really just doing a vernacularization from another text, right? So they're participating in a different translation process, quote unquote. So I think you're kind of giving us these examples, showing us how these different translations actually what the implication of it is to the text is what's happening in the first few chapters, and then you really streamline into focusing on Rumi. I did want to pick up on one thing, just because I think it was so fascinating for me is, and you kind of mentioned it already, how you talk about this in chapter three, really. How the music component really is like this challenging aspect of translation, especially with Persian poetry. You get this in a lot of Sufism, is that often the poetics was something that was embedded within music and meditative practices. So the poetry was one dimension of multiple other dimensions that were a part of meditation or zikr or, these aspects, not only in Persian context, but also we have some of this in South Asian context, like Kavali. So how does this make translation? I mean, reading this chapter, I almost was like, oh, translating is impossible, right? Like, because how do you try? And you have, charts and meters and show us this is a fantastic chapter. Have the musicality also has this other dimension, and how do you translate that, right? So did you want to flesh out this chapter a little bit for us and our reader?
Sure.
This listeners and our questions of untranslatability.
Sure. Before going back to the politics of translation, which I'm less interested in general, I love the technical aspects of it. When, as soon as it becomes more semiotic, I love it. I have published four articles on the music of Persian poetry and on the music of Rumi's poetry, and its relation to classical music, of Iranian classical music, two in English, two in French. The ones in English are in Rumi Maulana Rumi Review, MRR. That's the to my knowledge the only specialized the international journal specialized in Rumi studies. The other one is probably more technical, and it's well, the first one in the one published in Maulana Rumi Review is the is an article about the music of Rumi's poetry and how what role. I mean, it's not necessarily I'm not talking about translation there. I'm talking about how a music is an inseparable component of Rumi's poetry. The other one is more general about Persian poetry and Iranian music and the way they're interconnected, structurally interconnected, not just metaphorically. We don't talk about the language of music or the music of language in a metaphoric, figurative way. Actually, there are structural interconnections. So the epitome of this phenomenon is Rumi's Divan and Rumi's ghazals, Rumi's odes, as you know, ghazals, sonnets or odes, depending on your translation. This is the epitome of the musicality of Persian classical poetry, mystical or non-mystical, Sufi or non-Sufi. So what I try to show in these articles and in this chapter is that, again, to put it in a nutshell, to say it in the simplest way possible, if not simplistic, is that mystics, let's talk about the poetry first. So the structure of Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and Ottoman Turkish poetry, they're all based on a system, a metric system that is called aruz, or arud in Arabic. That's a poetic system. There are different theories as to the origins of this metric system. Metric system is basically how you create rhythm in a verse. That's a metric. You have a meter, that is the number of syllables and the arrangement of syllables in a single verse or in a hemistich, and how you measure these lengths to the length of the total verse in a way to equalize the number of syllables to make it rhythmical, to make the linguistic utterance rhythmical. So that's the definition of a meter. According to some theories, it's based on Sanskrit. According to other theories, it's purely it comes from Semitic languages, Aramaic and then Arabic, which is probably more. Well, I'm not familiar enough with Sanskrit, especially not Sanskrit poetry, but to my knowledge, Hebrew and Quran, the Hebrew Bible and Quran, have similar metric structures, similar, not exactly the same, but similar metric structures. There's a very interesting work, a poetician called Henri Méchonique in French, who worked on the translation of Bible, saying that basically all translations of Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, in all Indo-European languages are false because they don't respect the rhythm. That's a big claim. And he actually writes probably over 10,000 pages to justify that. That's five, six volumes of poetics, poetics of text, I mean, in general. Anyhow, so back to the question of poetry. Of Rumi's poetry, Rumi as a mystic, in my opinion, that's not my opinion, actually. There's a paradox about Rumi. He shows his hatred of language and of poetry in many occasions. And at the same time, he's one of the most prolific authors of the entire history of human world literature. He has 128,000 verses, and a verse, I mean a distich, that is two verses. 60,000 distichs and 128,000 verses. So that's much bigger than Homer, Milton, and Dante altogether. So he's a prolific author while he hates language. So how can we explain that paradox? Well, Rumi, like many other mystics, think that the human language is not capable of expressing, and I by expressing, well, I don't, I didn't, I just use expressing in my technical language of, in that chapter. If you take the time and effort to read the through the first part of the second chapter, what I talk a lot about semiotization, how we semiotize the world, how a phenomenon that exists outside our head, basically outside our mind, is turned into a sign, which is the word, the linguistic word, the verbal term that we use. Well, I look at a tree, I call it tree, I call it derakht in Persian, I call it shajar in Arabic. Doesn't matter how I call it in terms of like pronouncing what phonemes I pronounce, but there's a reality outside my mind, that's the tree itself, and then the word I use to refer to it. So this word, this is a sign. The signifier is the sound you hear, and the signified is the reality of the tree. So for mystics, the reality of their mystical experience on the one hand, and the reality of the ultimate truth that is God, if we may call it, on the other hand, is so complex that no natural language can semiotize that, can find a sign to mean, to signify that reality, that truth, that ultimate truth, or even the quality of that mystical experience, that ecstatic instant in terms of you get out of yourself, you get out of your stats, your being, basically. You get out of your being, you get out of yourself. So that ecstatic experience cannot be expressed in words, to put it simple. That there's no sign, there's no word, there's no language to talk about that. So what shall we do? At the same time, someone like Rumi cannot resist the urge, this pulsion, that's a pulsion, the interior, this internal force that pushes him towards talking about this experience, about this reality, this ultimate truth. So the paradox that this dialectical conflict within Rumi materializes itself in the form of 128,000 verses, of, well, at least half of which, the ones belonging to Divan, the odes, are not only linguistic utterances, but they're literally, and I have shown it in my analysis, they're literally musical phrases. Because you don't need a melody, you just need to read the poem of Divan, just any poem of Divan, and you are playing music, you're singing, basically. The poem is being sung automatically. So this is the way, this is the strategy, that's his strategy, that devised by Rumi and similar poets in Persian literature, mystical literature, and non-mystical, but specifically Rumi, devised by the author to not only communicate his message through language, using the language, but using a language of ecstasy. How? By reading and by singing and by dancing and rotating on his rhythmical poems, you reach a certain level of consciousness, let's say, or you reach a certain state of ecstasy, of trance, that the message of the poem comes to you, is absorbed by you in a more efficient way, probably. I'm more of an analyst than experimenter. I have not done it myself, but I can see how it may work for people. And how can we translate that? We cannot. I'm trying to translate. I'm putting together an anthology of Rumi, and I'm calling it the musical anthology of Rumi. Bad news is that it's in French, because there are a lot of translations in English. French is particularly poor. Divan is the ghazals of Divan, the odes of Divan is, are very poorly represented in French. So, as a French speaker, I tried to start at least my first attempt in French. I'm not a translator. I'm a translation studies scholar. I'm not a great translator myself. I do confess that. But my way of translating those, and we'll get to that. Well, first of all, they're extremely literal. So I try these translations to be as close to the semantic content of poems as possible, as structurally possible. I mean, grammatically, linguistically possible in French, as close as possible. Even if my text will be very hard for French speakers, modern French speakers to read, and I don't care. And we can talk about that. That's a question I have talked a lot about in my last chapter, The Ethics of Translation. And the second component is the music. I'm going to read those poems in Persian, put them somewhere on the net, give the link to all the readers readers of my translations to go and listen to the poems while reading the French text. So this way they can get a taste of how the poem sounds in the original language and what they mean literally. The first level of meaning, the first level of signification. So that's my way of tackling untranslatability.
You also had trouble saying it, which is good. I don't feel so bad.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm used to saying it in French, intraduisibilité,
Yeah, that feels
en
much better. That's much
fait.
nicer. I like it. Yeah. It's so interesting. And I could hear you talk about this for hours because there's such so many dimensions. And as you say, there's like this inherent tension, but it's also this inherent tension that's just not about translation. But as you kind of talk about in the introduction, it's an inherent tension of just kind of mystical traditions. And then it's an inherent tension of Rumi, right? And so there's just like consistent paradoxes across all of the theoretical frameworks or kind of the case study itself that I think it's just so rich. And your book is so rich and dense in that way because you really get into the details and like the really minute aspects of it, which, I think for translation studies scholars, this would just be such a wonderful, juicy book to engage and sit with. And I think we're both edging to get into the reception politics because that's where I'm excited about it. But it was the last few chapters that I really found fascinating in terms of like you've set up the fact that here are all the challenges and limitations of doing translation in this context, as it seems like there's something that's going to be left behind or something that's lost or something that's untranslatable, right? Yet all these translations, especially in the English language, abound, right? And there's so many quotes that I've highlighted, and I wanted to read one that you have in your conclusion on page 272 that says, "Yet translation exists against all odds. In fact, Rumi translations not only exist, but are abundant. The case of Rumi shows how translation lies at the core of a conflictual zone where the translator is constantly divided between opposing sentiments of joy and sorrow, the joy of gain and the sorrow for loss. Just as Rumi's internal urge to express the ineffable pushed him to compose tens of thousands of verses while constantly decrying the ineptitude of human language, as you were just talking about, Rumi translators could not resist the urge to share the wealth and depth of his message with their respective readers while understanding the essential limits of this feat." And so this is, I think you frame it in different ways as like a discursive distortion, or these are adaptations or hypertext, right? And as you also said earlier, it's these texts that are perhaps more have, verged farther away from the literal translation, but have captured a different tone in their adaptations that have been resonant in kind of the Rumi mania phenomena. So what do we do with this is the question. And I think this is what you're grappling with in the last two chapters of the book.
What do we do with this? We need to accept it first. The second thing is we have to let the reader know of what's going on. We have to put them in the know. They have a right to know about the reality of the original text. That's why I'm a big fan of explanatory, explicative notes by the translator that share the challenges with the reader. Just a simple example was, for instance, the question of gender. I would love to see all translators bring up this matter with their readers. Explain that we never know. There are opposing views on what is the nature, what is the meaning, what is this ultimate interpretation of the Bashic, profane images of mystical poetry, and how we will never be able to give a definite interpretation and let the readers know about it. And the third thing, in my opinion, that's more my opinion, that's more debatable. I'm a big fan of literal translation because I think you can never recreate that's the paradox I talked about, adaptations or open or literary translations. I was arguing that the paradox is that you will never be able to recreate neither the rhythm nor the rhyme nor the internal semantic rhetoric, the figures of speech of Rumi in the target language. So why should we sacrifice the semantic content on the altar of readability and literarity of the target text? So let's have a target text that is hard to read, full of notes, probably embellish it with other things. I don't know. Add music to it. It's like we live in the 21st century. You can always add audio to book. I mean, links, you can always add links, put the music somewhere. But let's be as close to the semantic content of the original text while explaining it in explicative but not exegetic notes. Let's not interpret the text, just explain the situation. That when I have given the example of meta-translative or meta-linguistic text talking about, for instance, the gender and the other explicative notes that talk about the situation. I don't know, there's somewhere in Masnavi where Rumi talks about not washing a shahid, a martyr, because he's covered with blood. Well, you have to explain this. This is allusion to some Islamic ritual that you have to wash the dead body, but you don't do that with the martyrs. These are things that are very hard to understand if you're not familiar with the original culture, with the target, with the source culture. And these are the I mean, this is the kind of information you need to share with your reader. And voila, for me, untranslatability is a destiny which we should do our best to avoid. We should challenge it. And well, this brings me to this debate, this polemic debate about open translation and literal translation, taken by Lawrence Venuti in a sharp turn from his original position, because he was the he's the prominent, probably the most prominent translation studies scholar in the English speaking world today. He's been so since at least for 2 or 3 decades. So first he was a big supporter of literal translation and ethical translation, and what he was the main translator of Antoine Berman, who's the French theorist who inspired by the German idealist theories of translation in the 19th century, advocated for what he called foreignizing translation. So Laurence Venuti was his translator in English. He was the one who developed his Antoine Berman's theories in English. But in his most recent work, he had a sharp turn, and he would argue that probably foreignizing translation is not necessarily a literalist translation, that the text, the original text, is open to growth, to interpretation. There is no interpretation. There's no meaning, basically. There's no truth about the text, and any truth can be attributed to it. Hence, any open translation, no matter how far from the original text, could have its value. Well, I tried to polemicize with this point of view in the book, basically arguing that the fact that the truth is not attainable doesn't mean that we should not go towards it. And in translation, because we are doomed to untranslatability, it doesn't mean that we can translate anything and call it translation. There's this notion that I borrowed from Victor Hugo. He talks about a truth as an asymptotic, asymptote. Asymptote is basically when there's a direct line that approaches a curve that approaches a direct line without ever reaching it. So it's like a tangent. Now, that's a mathematical notion that Victor Hugo uses about truth, but I use it about translation. I think translation by nature is an asymptotic operation. You try to get as close as possible to the truth of the original text, to the original text, to its letter and its content, as much as possible without reaching it. But it's okay. Just because we cannot reach it doesn't mean that we should stop trying. Voilà. That's my ultimate position in this debate of untranslatability and literal versus open, targetist versus source oriented translation in translation studies, which is an interminable debate, by the way. Yeah. In translation studies, yeah, we can never reach a conclusion.
But I think, you know, one of the things I really appreciated about your concluding chapters and as I'm hearing you talk is precisely that. Like, I think there's like ethical responsibility. I'm like really struck by your framing that there's an ethical responsibility of the translator or adapter to be transparent about what it is that they're doing and how it is that they did it. And I think in an era in which Rumi is being consumed at the level it is, I really appreciate that kind of responsibility as like honesty as a way of proceeding. And so it's not necessarily to stop what they're doing, but to be honest and clear about what it is they're doing and how they're doing it, right? Because as you say, we can't stop it because it's already has happened. And people are responding to, let's say, certain forms of translation, as you say in your book, by Coleman Barks or Kabir Helinsky. But you also highlight that, you know, maybe translations by Nicholson or Schimmel in certain instances have been a little bit more literal, right? And so it hasn't always been consistent either, right? So I really do appreciate that you've laid it all out for us and that you've mapped it out for us. And I know for me, I found the book so productive and I learned a lot. Not fully translation studies and semiotics, but I definitely tried to grapple with some of the more technical and theoretical aspects of it. So I'm really, really impressed, like amazing stuff that you're doing. Really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really interesting to sit with it. What are you working on these days? Before we say goodbye, I've taken up a lot of your time and you've really guided us through a lot of the dimensions of the book and we haven't even gotten to some of the details. So I really encourage our listeners to pick up the book. But you kind of hinted at something that you're working on in terms of French translation. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Or is there other projects that are also on the go for you after you've completed this important, really, like it seems like a long-term project that you've been working on. So congratulations. But yeah, what's up for you the next few years?
I have two sets of projects, short term and medium to long term. So the short term project is to publish two articles on the translation of rhetoric, Persian rhetoric, and how it could be challenging and how it could be quite easy, actually. I'm sharing with you the conclusions of my article of comparative rhetoric, because there I'm using again Rumi's poetry as my corpus to show how Persian rhetoric could differ from European languages and in what ways it can present a challenge and in what ways it can actually be easy, quite easy. That's the article. That's short-term project in French, unfortunately. I don't know for you.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, of course, French. Not unfortunate at all. Yeah.
I have finished translating. I have finished the first draft of my anthology, musical anthology, in French. Musical anthology of Rumi. Lots of odes and quatrains, but mostly odes, but some quatrains of Rumi in French. And as I explained, I will have an audio component with the book, so that the readers can listen to the original poem and read it, the meaning of it in French. With the text, I mean, it depends on the editor, but I prefer to have the Persian text and the French text next to each other, en regard, as we say in French, so that they can see the harmony, that the visual harmony of Persian of Rumi's poetry, because there's also harmony in that. It's not just musical. It's also there's the kinetic harmony in the dance of Sama. There's the visual harmony of the graphic aspect of poetry. It's just one level. Music and language are just two levels of many levels of signification, basically signifying modes of Rumi's poetry. In the long run, I'm turning my semiotic view over to Shiism. I am interested in working on Shiism and Shia symbolism, Shia narratology. I mean, looking at religion as a text, I try to find similarities between Christianity and Shiism, structural similarities. So it's a multi-level semiotic analysis of Shiism as a text. If we take this phenomenon, this religion, this branch of Islam as a text, how can we analyze it? How can we describe it from a semiotic standpoint? Its symbols, its narratives, its structure, its rituals. Voilà. So I'm gonna go to a similar but different at the same time topic.
Ah, oh, très bien. It's like fabulous. Yeah, congrats. Everything sounds fabulous. And I know some of our listeners will be really interested in some dimensions of your future work. Thank you so much. Merci beaucoup. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being with us and sharing all this amazing work. And I know our listeners will want to pick up the book and engage with it so much more. And I know there's a time difference. So I really appreciate that you made the time to connect with us as well for the podcast. Thanks, Mir.
Thank you for having me.
And that was my conversation with Amir Sadakat about his new book, Translating Rumi into the West, A Linguistic Conundrum and Beyond. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for supporting the New Books in Islamic Studies podcast. And we hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, take good care.